that his hands were trembling slightly. "Is it true, then?" Malik asked. "You have connections to the Mafia?"
Gaetano lit the cigarette and puffed the cloud of bluish smoke toward the ceiling.
"I have friends who can help you find Randolph."
"The Mafia?" Malik insisted.
"Call them whatever you want to," said Gaetano. "You want the man dead? So do I. We can work together to see that he never bothers us again."
"The Mafia," Malik repeated.
He turned his back to Gaetano, went to the windows and stared out at the gray Paris sky. It always seemed to be gray these days, he thought. It seems as if I haven't seen a blue sky in years.
"You can't turn your back on us," Gaetano said, his voice brittle with suppressed anger. "You and I have been working together for many months now. You are part of my organization, whether you like it or not."
Malik said nothing. He wished that Gaetano would disappear.
"I will see to it that Randolph is found, and done away with. Then we can go on with our plans for organizing the world's industries."
Malik waited until he heard his office door click shut. When he turned around, he noticed the new nameplate that his secretary had placed on his desk for his approval. V.S. Malik, Chairman. He tasted ashes in his mouth. Gaetano strode along the hallway to his own office, thinking furiously. "Malik is a reluctant ally, but he'll go along with what I want him to do. He has to. He has no other choice. Jane Scanwell is the dangerous one. She's in league with Randolph, probably in love with the bastard." By the time he reached his office and closed the door behind him, though, he was smiling. Why not use Jane to lure Randolph into the open? That would work, and then both of them can die in the same accident. The more he thought about his idea, the more he liked it. And once the two of them are out of the way, he told himself, Don Marcello can at last have the fatal heart attack I've been waiting for. Gaetano actually whistled happily as he sat at his desk and picked up the telephone handset. There was no way to hush up Dan Randolph's brash interruption of Malik's media conference. Not when Dan had been seen by more than 100 million TV viewers. GEC public relations flacks tried to deflect reporters' questions. Randolph is a criminal, a fugitive from justice. He's sore because the GEC stripped him of his company. Yes, but how did he break into the BBC and CNN transmissions? How did he do that? We're investigating that. Both those networks are beefing up their security, and we're installing new protective circuits in all the communications satellite ground stations.
You mean he broke into the ground stations?
Electronically, yes. That seems to be what he did. We're checking out that line of investigation. There was no physical break-in. It looks as if he managed to override the uplink transmissions from Earth to the satellites and insert his own transmission in place of what the uplinks were carrying. But how could he do that? Where did he transmit from? We're looking into that. You don't know? Not yet. But one thing is for certain. With the new protective programs we're adding to the ground stations, he'll never be able to do it again. 2 days later, the UNESCO Educational Channel was running a program about global warming. Schools all around the world tuned in to see the top experts from major universities discuss the possibilities of drastic changes in the global climate. "Much of the problem stems from human activity," said a geophysicist from Kenya, his thick white hair a startling contrast to his deeply black skin.
"Yes," agreed the moderator, a world-famous actress who had turned activist when her career began to slump. "As I understand it, atmospheric pollution from human sources is now a bigger factor than all the natural sources of pollutants combined."
"If by natural sources of pollutants you mean volcanic eruptions and animal wastes, then yes, it is true. Humans are ruining the atmosphere at an alarming rate."
"What about the greenhouse cliff?" asked Dan Randolph. His grinning image suddenly appeared between the moderator and the scientist. The moderator and scientist went on speaking as if nothing had happened, because the show had been taped in advance of its airing. But their sound went off, and Dan Randolph's image seemed to hover between them like an elf or a leprechaun.
"They're not telling you about the greenhouse cliff, kids," Dan said cheerfully. "There's a strong chance that the climate is going to shift abruptly within a few years. Think about it.
What would you do if the sea level was going to rise by 10 meters or more? Before the shocked schoolchildren could react, before their stunned teachers could think to turn off their TV sets, Dan's image disappeared and the original show droned on as if nothing had happened. But that evening, 12 million children asked their parents what a greenhouse cliff was. Both the World Cup soccer game and cricket match were interrupted by Dan Randolph. His image seemed to appear randomly on television broadcasts, ranging from daytime soap operas to a live presentation of Aida from the Baths of Caracalla in Rome. Dan appeared during one of the intermissions. Opera lovers appreciated his courtesy. He never was on the screen for more than 30 seconds. He spoke about the greenhouse cliff and the fact that the world was facing an inexorable crisis. The GEC's answer is to take control of all the world's industries, Dan said, for once his elfin smile gone, his face grim. That means they're taking control of all the world's jobs. They stole my company from me. What will they be stealing from you? Reporters all over the world beat themselves into exhaustion, trying to find Dan Randolph, trying to get Malik or anyone in the GEC to reply to his charges. Zach Freiberg appeared on nationwide TV in the United States and explained what the greenhouse cliff was. But 24 other scientists gave interviews belittling Zach's views and casting doubt on his credibility. After all, said one kindly-looking white-haired woman, he did work for Dan Randolph, didn't he? She herself worked for Rockledge Industries under GEC management. Finally, after 2 weeks of uproar, Jane Scanwell announced that she would give a news conference in Paris to respond to Dan Randolph's charges on behalf of the GEC. Malik knew that Jane would confirm everything Randolph had been saying. It will be a disaster for us, he moaned to Gaetano. Then we must not permit her to meet the reporters, said the Italian. 35. Dan shivered slightly as he sat in the bare wooden chair and hunched closer to the fire. It can't be the radiation, he told himself for the 40th time that morning. I'm just not accustomed to the cold. It was snowing again. Through the cabin's only decent window, Dan could see the white flakes sifting down gently, quietly, cold and still as death. He shuddered again inside the quilted coat he had thrown over his shoulders. Then he got up from the chair to toss another stick on the fire. Now I know how Cy must feel, he thought, bottled in liquid nitrogen. His campaign was going well. It was fun to twist their tails. Those pompous asses at the GEC. Must be 22 zillion security agents and news reporters trying to figure out how I'm able to break into the TV transmissions. Flatlanders, all of them. It had been ridiculously easy, although physically arduous. Nearly 4 months ago, Mason Dixon had taken a vacation in space. From Liechtenstein, he drove to Milan and caught the space plane to Rockledge Industries' tourist hotel in orbit. He chose Rockledge's space station because, in addition to its famous zero-G hotel, the satellite also housed a considerable satellite repair and refurbishment facility. For a suitable exchange of money, one of the Rockledge technicians spent a week in Mason Dixon's plush luxury suite at the hotel, while Dan replaced him at his job. The man was a maintenance technician whose specialty was working on the communications satellites in geostationary orbit, 22,300 miles above the Earth. Dan rode an orbital transfer vehicle to the Clark orbit together with a team of human and robot technicians. He spent most of his time inside the shielded OTV, as did the rest of the humans, directing the robots who went out to work on individual satellites in the high radiation flux of the upper Van Allen belt. At week's end, he returned to the hotel, became Mason Dixon once again, and after a weekend of rest, returned to Earth. Each of the commsats that his crew worked on now carried a miniaturized electronics package that allowed Dan to override the signal coming up from Earth and beam his own signal down the receiving antennas around the globe. The price, though, had been high. Dan had to pay hush money to each of the other 4 technicians in the OTV, and he had been exposed to more radiation than he liked to think about. Dan had to go EVA several times to make sure that the small-witted robots had done their jobs correctly. Even inside the OTV, the radiation dosimeters constantly hovered in the yellow warning area. The standing joke among the four other men and